Thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be here. A couple of years I was here, and I went parasailing and took this picture, and I can tell you I strongly recommend it. Santa Barbara is even more beautiful from up there than it is from down here, if you can imagine that. So it's very, very nice. Anyway, welcome. Thanks for inviting me. And today I want to tell you about the phase diagram of the high-TC superconductors. So the experiment is done by these people in the group, and we collaborate with other people who help us. And the theory, we got help from Mike Norman, Mohit Randeria, and Chandra Varma. Samples are from Elaine Rafi and Z Lee and David Hinks at Argonne. So let me tell you about a little bit about photo emission then. Just a brief introduction. I imagine many of you already know about this, but let me just do it. So what does photo emission really tell us? Well, how does it work? Well, we send in a photon, and the photon gets absorbed by an electron in an occupied state. And then if it can make a transition to an unoccupied state, if this energy is greater than the vacuum energy, the energy of two particles at infinity, this electron comes out with this much kinetic energy. So there's conservation of energy. The photon energy is equal to the kinetic energy plus the work function plus the binding energy. Now, it turns out that the highest occupied state here will be the highest electron that we get out with the highest kinetic energy. So if we plot the number of electrons as a function of their kinetic energy, our spectrum will end here because all these states are unoccupied. Right? So if we then make a transition from an allowed state to another empty allowed state, we'll get a peak. And the distance from this peak to this edge is the binding energy of the state. And that gives us one of the quantum numbers. The other one we want to know is the momentum of the electron in the solid. And that we can measure by measuring the angle at which the electron comes out. Because in the vacuum, the electron is just a proper particle, and its momentum is given by that. And so if we just multiply by the angle, sine of this angle, we get the momentum parallel to the surface. And in photo emission, both energy and momentum are conserved. Right, so here's an experiment to show you what's going on. So each of these curves corresponds to one angle of the analyzer. And here you see a peak, right? So as you change the analyzer angle, this peak moves. And for each one of these peaks, we can plot the energy of this peak and the momentum position in this diagram. And so we get the dispersion curve. And you can see that this peak is moving up to the Fermi energy here, and then it disappears, no more peak. The other thing you can notice is that down here, the peak is very broad, and here it's very sharp, and you all know that the lifetime increases as you approach the Fermi energy. So we can also measure the lifetime. And nowadays we have more sophisticated analyzers where we get all of this at once. So here we're measuring energy and momentum all directly in one experiment. And you can just by eye see these curves that we looked at so much in our textbooks. And here you can see that this peak is very broad here, and it gets narrower and narrower when it reaches the Fermi energy. Okay. Yes? This is about 200 millivolts here. 200, yeah. Okay, but ARPES tells us a little bit more. What we measure is actually the spectral function. So the photo emission intensity is proportional to the matrix element, the probability of moving an electron from an initial state to a final state by the dipole operator, times the spectral function, we have a many body system here, times the Fermi function, because we're looking at Fermi excitations. And you all know what this is. And this is a really interesting part of the spectrum, but sometimes we also use that. Now, there are two ways to analyze this data. One way is a conventional way, which is to fix the energy, fix the momentum and plot the energy distribution. And these are called energy distribution curves. And the other way, now that we can measure this whole thing in one shot, is to fix the momentum the energy, and plot it as a function of momentum. So here's momentum, and at a fixed energy. So this happens to be at the Fermi energy. So if you are at omega equals zero, this peak automatically tells you what KF is by definition. Now you can see that these two are very different, and that is a direct consequence of the fact that this material is not a Fermi liquid, as I will try to explain it to you. Now the other question is, you would say, well, here's a peak. What is this big step in here in your spectrum? Where does your spectral function end? For many years we said, oh, this is just a background, and people would say, well, how do you know, since the system is so strongly correlated, what is peak and what is background? And here's the answer to that. What you do is you take a cut across here and one through the peak, and you vary the photon energy, and you see that those two have very different matrix elements, right? So this background thing here doesn't change an awful lot when you change the photon energy. The peak changes a huge amount. So the peak is not connected to this background. We don't yet know what that background is. We have no idea where it's coming from, but whatever it is, it's not interesting compared to the peak. Okay? All right, so we'll derive all the information from the peak, and we'll just ignore the background. It's not the incoherent part of the spectral function. This is the incoherent part of the spectral function. The background is just this flat part here. And this flat part is constant everywhere. Okay, so out of this flat part rise these peaks. Okay, and you can see more clearly that when you take this cut. You see, here's the flat part, and that's just the background, and the peak just rises out of there.
Sorry, I have a question. Yeah?
Okay.
On that red?
Yes. Yes.
What would you assign to background?
Okay, that's the hard part. That's why it's better to do this analysis than this. So where's the background? Where does the peak end and the background start? That's very hard. And what you do is you do this experiment and you fix the background here, and you do that as a function of energy, and then you subtract this from here.
Right. Then you can come back.
Then you can come back from this. But there are many reasons why you don't want to use this, and I'll show you that in a couple of minutes. So. Let's look at this part of the strange metal here. What does ARPIS tell us about the normal state in this material? So if we do the photoemission here, let me just first make qualitative statements, okay? So this is the reciprocal lattice. So these directions are the copper-oxygen bond direction, and this is diagonal to the copper-oxygen bond direction. We see that the peak is sharpest, so, and this is a Fermi energy. These are whole superconductors, so this is the empty whole Fermi surface. These are the filled states here. So as we cross the Fermi energy, the peaks are the sharpest, and let's look at the sharpest peak, which is at the nodal, in the nodal direction, the nodal quasiparticles. And we can estimate its lifetime just from the uncertainty principle, delta E, delta T is H bar. And we find that this peak doesn't live very long. It lives 4 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds. And we can calculate its velocity because I showed you before, there it is. Okay, from the derivative of this, you just calculate the velocity of the electron. Sorry, this will take a few seconds. So you know the velocity, you know the lifetime, and therefore you can calculate what its mean free path is. And you find that even though it's traveling very fast at roughly a tenth of the velocity in copper, pure copper metal, it just doesn't live long enough to go more than a couple of unit cells. So I don't think you would call this a quasiparticle in any sense of the word and write down Bloch's equations. All right, so this is some strange beast, and whatever it is not quasiparticles. So let's look briefly at the question that Antoine asked. What are the
consequences?
Well, I will show you plenty of quasiparticles in just a minute, okay? Okay, so what are the consequences of this non-Fermi liquid behavior? If we just write the spectral function in this very generic form, what you can see is that there are two ways I can analyze this, as I showed you before. I can plot this at constant K and write it as a function of energy, the energy distribution curve, and these are these strange-looking curves, which are not Lorentzian. What that means is that there are very strong energy dependence into the imaginary part of the self energy, right? Very, very strong. And therefore, the peak position in this spectrum is not actually given by the zero of this term in the denominator. All right, so I really, by looking at that spectra, I really learned very little, because there are so many strong corrections to the self energy that I just don't know. I can't really interpret it very well. Although people do, in fact, but you can't. So you have to really look at constant omega and plot it as a function of k. And what you find it is that it's a very nice Lorentzian. And this tells you that the self energy does not depend on k perpendicular to the Fermi surface. Right? So this is the first thing that you derive from this simple analysis, is that there is no k dependence in the imaginary part of the self energy perpendicular to the Fermi surface, which is already quite strange. But also, you get the nice result that because this is a Lorentzian, the peak of this Lorentzian, the spectral function, is at the zero of this term, right? So you can immediately read the dispersion from here without any strong corrections that you know nothing about. And you also read the width of this thing. It's because the width of your spectrum is directly related to the imaginary part of the self-energy divided by the unrenormalized Fermi velocity, which you can presumably get from band structure calculation or something. And you can see really how strong the non-Fermi liquid behavior is here, because if you plot the dispersion from here and from here, you get two different things, right? They're not the same. And that's just a consequence of the fact that this thing is not a Fermi liquid. So no matter how you look at it, you always arrive at this conclusion. It's not a Fermi liquid. So you have to be very careful in the analysis if you want to make some meaningful corrections. So what are the lessons that we learned so far from the normal state? There are no quasi-particles. There's no, I didn't tell you that we have been looking at only one peak here, all right, one peak. And yet we're looking at bismuth 2212, which has two layers per unit cell, okay? And so how come the two layers, which are only 3 angstroms apart, so the copper to copper distance is 3-point-some angstroms, and the layer to layer spacing is 3-point-some angstroms, how come they don't split up? You have just one rather sharp peak here, okay? So there's no bilayer splitting. And this, I guess it goes with, or at least conceptually, with the idea that the electrons are not coherent. They don't have enough coherence to just jump from one layer to the other and interact with in a coherent way with each other.
Well, Carlos, yeah. We heard a talk by Golden a few months ago.
Yes.
That they can see bilayer splitting by improving the resolution and playing with the photon energy.
Yes. Well. The only comment I have is that their results are okay. I don't have anything against their results, but they're using a sample with 40% lead doping. Okay, that 40% lead doping, and I've never seen the pseudo gap in that sample, so I don't know that it's actually underdoped. Okay, it's overdoped, and I will show you in overdoping. You can see the bilayer splitting.
Well, I think he was making this point that he could see it in overdoped.
Yeah, right. I'm talking about underdope, the strange state.
The reason why they had to put the lead was because apparently that lead reduces some superstructure that this material has.
Okay, we do the same thing by some clever way, which I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay.
Well, we don't, but Alain Raffi does. Okay? All right. So the other thing that we deduce from looking at this is that the imaginary part of the self-energy has some very simple form. Okay, the imaginary of the self-energy, part of the self-energy just goes like A plus B omega. And here is, when you go around the Fermi surface, each one of these curves is the dispersion of the momentum distribution and the width, sorry, as a function of energy. So that from that you just get this formula. And you see how A and B vary. Basically, B, this coefficient, doesn't change when you go around the Fermi surface, but the A changes. So we don't understand what that means. That's up to you guys to figure it out. So, all right.
Can you just say, where's A largest or smallest? Which direction would that
correspond? Okay, so this is the nodal direction. This is the antinodal direction.
Okay?
All right. So this is Kx here, 0, 1.
What temperature is this at?
This is in the normal state.
Okay.
Well, no, it isn't. Not really. Okay. No. Well, there is the temperature dependence comes in here through its square root of omega squared plus t squared, right? So the temperature dependence in this self-energy, if I would have to put a so to a rough approximation, okay? I would replace this omega by omega squared plus b squared. Okay? Okay. I know you're not happy, but you don't look happy. How can you be in Santa Barbara and not look happy? Anyway. Sorry, I'm giving you a hard time. So what happens in the superconducting state? So this is at pi zero again. This is the broad peak I showed you before. Okay, here it is in the normal state. And then when we go into the superconducting state, we get a quasiparticle. You wanted to see one. There it is. Huge quasiparticle. And now this thing has a very strange behavior, you see. Because what this implies is that, well, we've got quasiparticles. You can see them. And what this collapse of the width from very broad peak to a very sharp peak, this implies that there's been a collapse of the scattering rate, right? And the scattering rate has collapsed in some dramatic manner, which has been first measured by Martin Nuss, I think, right after these materials were discovered. And it collapses like mad along the antinodal direction. It collapses with a frequency, with a power of at least omega to the 6. That's very large. And the only way you can get that is if the electron is, or this is mathematically equivalent to the interaction of an electron with a collective mode. I'm not going to go into any detail in this talk about this collective mode, but just looking at the spectrum, you have to sort of conclude that there's some collective mode. Perhaps it's a phonon, perhaps it's a spin fluctuation, I don't know. Whatever it is, well, we think it's spin fluctuations, but I'm not going to discuss it now, but certainly the electron is interacting with some collective mode.
Why this is not a bilayer splitting?
Oh, I will tell you why there isn't a bilayer splitting. Just a moment.
Huh? I couldn't understand that graph on the right. You're measuring this quasi-particle at different points in the Fermi.
No. This is just at one point, and we look at the this is the width of the thing as a function of energy. Okay? This is the EDC, but that's right. Yeah, I'm showing the EDC here, but this is the width of the MDC as a function of energy, and it's a very dramatic collapse. And it's the thing seen that's seen in optics and whatever, that you know the scattering rate just you know drops dramatically at DC. Okay, and all I'm pointing out is that such a large drop tells you that there's something besides just temperature in here. Okay. So now the next question is, what is the width of this quasi-particle peak as a function of doping? Or
sorry, how does that width compare to the width of the metal
point? In our experiments, they're the same because we're momentum energy resolution limited and momentum resolution limited. All right, so you have to ask the optics guy how fast it really drops. It drops two orders of magnitude, but because of our resolution, we're...
So in the normal point, you see resolution.
Yeah, we see the sharp peak also. The peak sharpens up, but that's a long story. I wasn't going to go into that, okay? I want to really give an overall picture of the phase diagram.
Or
in our experiments? In our experiments, is about... varies for every spectra I show you, but it's between 10 and 15 millivolts. Okay. Okay. So what is the weight of this quasi-particle peak? And we saw a picture from Dimitri earlier that showed that it varied linearly with doping. And so we can just sort of attempt to extract it too, and we find that lo and behold, it goes like X. And this was done by CX, Shen also. Same results. Okay, so the quasi-particle weight goes linearly with the doping. Okay. Now this is an interesting thing because there's a really a fundamental difference in some sense between a regular phase transition and a high TC phase transition, in the sense that in any regular phase transition, the transition occurs when the temperature is of some energy scale in the problem. So say in conventional superconductivity is the gap. So you have this famous relationship. But in high TCs, there is no such relationship, because as you change the doping, the gap goes up, TC goes down. And I think that's just another consequence of the fact that there are no quasi-particles above TC. So here, the number of quasi-particles above and below TC is the same, but here there aren't any. So you have to fix that problem. And so if you, instead of using just delta, you use z times delta, then you find that you fix the problem, okay? That there is a universal relationship between delta and TC. And again, that's just reflecting the fact that above TC, there are no quasi-particles.
How long is z as a number?
Well, it varies all over the place, right? Depends on the doping, I'm sorry. Z times 10 to the minus 3, so that's the number right there. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, so what's the next point? So let's look at the phase transition then in the overdoped region here. From the strange metal in the overdoped region. And what, yes?
Can one actually go slightly away from the antinomic point and ask for the state dependence of the
quantum? Of the
what? Of the dependence on the angle around the quantum
circle. Of what?
Of the gate.
We could do that, but then you have a gap, so I don't know how to deal with that problem. Okay, yeah, we could. We haven't done it, but we could. Yes, you're right. Sorry, I forget my statement. You could, yes. I don't know the answer. I have a figure, which I can show you probably, but I don't know if I wish we ever extracted that. Also, let's look at the phase transition then here, going into the superconducting state. So here again is a normal state, right, at 95 Kelvin. This is at the Fermi energy at the nodal direction, but at the Fermi energy. And you see this spectrum is just cut off by the Fermi function. I told you that what we measure is the matrix element times the spectral function times the Fermi function. And this, which I had written before, this comment complicates the interpretation of the data, because you'll see as you lower the temperature, as I showed you, the peak gets sharper and sharper as the scattering rate is dropping, right? And then at the lowest temperature, it's very sharp. And if you plot the Fermi function, this peak is far away from the Fermi function. So this is more representative of what it really is. But somewhere up here, you can't really tell what's peak and what isn't, and how the superconducting gap evolves. So let's do a little trick. Let's divide the spectrum by the Fermi function. So if I just divide that over here, I'm left with just the spectral function. And that's what it looks like. So at high temperatures, I have a very broad peak centered at omega equals zero. The reason it's not here is because it's cut off by the Fermi function. It's 1/2 at the Fermi energy. But if I could divide, then I get this broad peak. And then you see as you lower the temperature, this peak not only gets sharper, but it also moves away from omega equals zero. And that's the superconducting gap, right? And then we can plot the superconducting gap as a function of temperature. And this is it right here, and it's just BCS-like. And in fact, it follows very closely the BCS order parameter. It's just mean field. And I guess as far as I know, superconductivity is the only mean field transition in nature, right? Does anybody know any other one? I'd be glad to know, but this is the only one. Or any superconducting transition. What? Physical TC is 90 Kelvin, or 90 something, okay? Okay, But if I go to an underdoped sample, the transition is no longer mean field. Okay? And I want to show you that now. So now we're going to, instead of going down here, we're going to go down here. And what you find is that at low temperature, so I'm really starting down here, you see there's a gap, there's a peak, the coherent peak. Here's a Fermi edge from just a non-superconducting polycrystalline metal. So that serves as our reference for our chemical potential. And as I raise the temperature, nothing much happens. This quasi-particle peak gets a little bit smaller, but that's about it. Smaller still. And then it disappears just about at TC. But lo and behold, I'm left with a gap, right? And I have to go to much, much higher temperatures before the gap disappears. So we have this situation. If I come down from high temperatures, what I find is first the gap opens, right? And then at a lower temperature, I get coherence and superconductivity right there. So as I come down, I form this pseudo gap is formed here. And only at TC, you get coherence and superconductivity. So this is really not a mean field transition at all. So it's dramatically changed from, say, this phase of this part of the doping to this part of the phase diagram. Okay, so the next question we want to ask then, the obvious question is this pseudo gap connected to the superconducting gap? And there are many, at the beginning we thought, well, there are many reasons why it should be connected, because you look at its momentum dependence and it's the same as a pseudo gap. You look at its energy dependence and one is just a multiple of the other. So whatever you look, and then when you look at the spectra, there's no obvious change as you go through TC. So the pseudo gap continuously evolves into the superconducting gap. So we thought, you know, it's just not mean field behavior. But then there were other from the beginning. And the other thing is that no broken symmetry has ever been observed. But then there always were from the very beginning of the field the suggestion that there might be currents that have been set up in the system, and that these perhaps break some subtle symmetries. Like these, for example, break translational symmetry, right? Because you double your unit cell. And we look for that very carefully. There is no evidence. This is a sample with a TC of only 10 Kelvin. Okay? So it's just barely superconducting. Now you go along the nodal direction and you can see the Fermi crossing right here very, very beautifully, everything. These are the umklaps. But then you go along here and there's nothing at the Fermi energy. There's just not even a hint of any electrons or states floating around. So this thing here, this nodal point, okay, it's just that, all right? This is not an arc resulting from doubling the unit cell. So nobody's ever found any evidence for any doubling of the, or breaking of the translational symmetry in the pseudogap state. So some other people proposed other models that perhaps don't do that, but still show these currents. So let's look for those effects if we can. And how can we look for, so the thing that was proposed is that perhaps time reversal is broken. And fortunately, photoemission can become sensitive to time reversal by looking at this matrix element. If we then, instead of using a linear operator here, we use a circularly polarized operator, and we look at the difference in emission between left polarized light and right polarized light at a mirror plane, then that will do the job. So that's what we're going to look for. Now we have to worry about the fact that there are geometric effects that come in. For example, this is the vector potential of the light. This is the initial state of the electron, and this is the final state of the electron. If those things, three things, are not in a plane, okay, when you calculate that matrix element, which is just a multiplication of these vectors, you don't get the same if you go around one way or the other way. They don't commute because of the axial nature of this vector here. So if you do that, you find that in fact there is dichroism. Left and right, or right and left are not the same. And if you then move to the other side of the mirror plane, if you change like that, then the whole thing reverses. And this has nothing to do with time reversal symmetry breaking. This is just the geometric face introduced from those three vectors not being coplanar. So to do the experiment properly, you have to be you have to have all vectors in a plane. But this was well known already from people who did molecules on surfaces and so on, magnetism. So that's all well established. But if you put all three vectors on a plane, then left and right polarization cannot give you difference emission if there is no time reversal symmetry breaking. And so this experiment tells us two things. First of all, so what do I mean by a mirror plane here? This mirror plane here is a copper oxygen bond direction. Now you ask most experimentalists and they will tell you, but that's not a mirror direction of the crystal. That's correct. It's not a mirror symmetry of the crystal because the outside part of the plane, the stuff that outside, has different symmetries. But the copper oxygen plane, the states in the copper oxygen plane, because we're only looking at the copper dx squared minus y squared state hybridized with oxygen 2p, we're only looking at that state. As far as that state is concerned, the copper oxygen plane has a mirror plane there. And here's the proof of it. Okay, so we don't have to make that assumption. We just find experimentally that that is a mirror plane for those states. Okay, because we're only looking at stuff in the copper oxygen plane. We don't care about the rest.
So are you testing a mirror plane symmetry or
what?
Are you testing a mirror plane symmetry or time reversal?
Well, right now I'm just testing the mirror plane symmetry. Okay. Then I'll test the rest. First, I have to make sure about what I'm doing. The other thing this experiment tells me is that we can do to very high precision, because this is an absolute measurement. We're measuring absolute intensities, and we can do it to, this gives us our limit, which is 0.06%. Okay, so now let's assume that the wave function does break time reversal symmetry. The other thing that we have to do is we have to come in with our beam perpendicular, otherwise this transformation won't be true, so we want to preserve that. And so, you see, now once you're in the mirror plane, you know from group theory that the wave function can only be of even or odd parity, right? You cannot have any old parity. And so the only way the wave function can break that parity is if you have this thing, this time reversal breaking term here, which transforms like that. And then it's just trivial to put this into the matrix element and calculate left minus right, and you find that at the mirror plane now, if you do have a time reversal breaking component, you will get a signal proportional to that, even though all three vectors are in the mirror plane. Okay? So it's pretty straightforward as far as I can tell, but there are always all kinds of artifacts that you could have to worry about. So here's how we do the experiment. This is our mirror plane. So we're going to take a cut perpendicular to the mirror plane here. And the light is coming in normal. And so we're looking at electrons which have momentum pi zero. Okay. So here's the data. Let's first look at an overdoped sample. Okay. So this is an overdoped sample. It doesn't have a pseudo gap. And what I'm going to plot is I'm going to integrate this peak. And I'll tell you why in a minute, just to get really good signal to noise ratio for a start. I'm interested in this state. And the integral of this peak is just the momentum distribution. And for a small cut perpendicular to this mirror plane, this should be a straight line, right? So we're going to plot this n of k versus k. And it should just be a straight line, and it is. Except it's tilted about the mirror plane. This is a mirror plane. And this is tilted. So for left-right light, it looks like that. And for right light, it looks like that. And the tilt here, away from this mirror plane, is just this geometric effect. All right? So you see that on this side, this is bigger than this. And on that side, this is smaller than that. Right? But it's still just, you know, as you would expect, just a straight line. And at the mirror plane, the two are identical. So that's why we have to do it this way, because you see, this is a very small momentum interval. It's 0.04 of half the Brillouin zone. Okay, so it's just a tiny little interval, but this effect is so large, it's of order one, that you know we have to make sure we can not confuse by this when we look at what happens right there. Okay, so now let's look at this. Well, I already told you that. Let's look at change the temperature then, and what happens is that the Fermi function just gets sharper, so at higher temperatures like that, at lower temperatures like that, we're still in a normal state. But again, left and right gives us zero signal at the mirror plane. Still no change. And then we can do that as a function of, we can then plot the normalized effect here and do that as a function of temperature, you see nothing happens. Okay, at the mirror plane, there's just, all the effects are just zero. And everything else is that geometric effect that we discussed before. All right, now let's go to the fun sample and underdoped sample. Okay, so this is at high temperature. And I'm going to then plot the signal with left circularly polarized light and right circularly polarized light. And again, at high temperature, nothing happens, right? Both give zero signal at the mirror plane. And now I'm going to lower the temperature and I get the pseudo gap here. I lost all these states here. They're all gone. I'm still in the pseudo gap state, not the superconducting state. And then if I plot left polarization and right polarization, lo and behold, the signal at the mirror plane is not the same. And something strange has happened. All right, so two things to worry about. Is it just that your mirror plane moved or not? And secondly, do you have an artifact because those two are not the same, but although you're looking at the same spectra with two polarizations, and then that one with two polarizations, it's we still have to worry about all those possibilities. So, but before let's do that, we do the thing as a function of temperature. So here it is at high temperature, zero signal. And as we lower the temperature, the effect gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we can increase the temperature again, and it goes right back to zero. Okay, so everything is reproducible, and you can run back and forth and so on. All right, so now let's look at this to see if this is not some artifact of this effect. We now are, instead of integrating it like we did here, I'm going to plot the whole signal. So this is energy, so we're looking at the effect. This is a dichroism as a function of energy of the state and the temperature. And you see that the whole state is undergoing this strange behavior. Okay, so this whole bandwidth is behaving strangely, right? The whole thing. It's not dependent on where you are in energy, the same, to within our error bars. Okay, so then let's worry about this mirror plane. So we can see that the mirror plane has not moved many ways. We can just look at the dispersion and we know where our mirror plane is there. It's right there. And here's a much higher resolution measurement of that. And what we did here is took that and reflected about the mirror plane. And so there are two sets of data here and you can't tell them apart. So to within 3 sigmas bigger than the effect that we measure, we know that the mirror plane hasn't moved. Because we know what, so if we look at that previous data, this corresponds to an angle shift of 3 degrees or something like that in our detector. And we can measure this to a precision of, I don't know, a quarter of a degree or something like that. So we know that that mirror plane has not moved. It's just there, right where it was. Okay? So it's not parity, which has been destroyed. It's really time reversal symmetry. And then we can go and do even higher resolution X-ray diffraction on these peaks, and we've done extensive work on that. And you cannot see any orthorhombic distortion. You see, it's the lattice parameter is changing, but that wouldn't do it. What happens is that the two axes have to change direction. You have to have an orthorhombic distortion, and that doesn't happen. Okay, so as far as we can tell, we can summarize that we find that in overdoped samples, there is no dichroism or signature of any time reversal symmetry, but in underdoped samples, there is. And what's and even if I had just this one measurement, I would worry about it. So we did it as a function of doping, okay, just to make sure. So you can see that these blue things mean no dichroism, red mean dichroism. So you see that whenever you cross a T-star line, that's when things happen, right? So you're up here, then you cross a T-star line, stuff happens. You're up here, you cross a T-star line, and so on. So really, this thing is tied to the T-star line. The effect is directly tied to this star. So this is some kind of something, this paired state, if we want to call it that, only because it has a gap, has some very strange properties to it, and I don't know what they are, and I hope someday somebody figures it out. Okay, now the last topic I want to tell you about is, you know, how does this thing, this strange metal that we've been discussing, how does it evolve to what we believe should be a Fermi liquid at high doping? You know, there's been this paper by Engelbrecht and Randiria that say that for, you know, very high doping, very low electron concentration, you can do a control calculation and you can show that it's a Fermi liquid. And you publish that and you upset Phil no end. Okay, but how does it evolve to the strange metal? So is it a continuous evolution, like Bob Laughlin argued in his Tale of Two Metals paper, or is there really a crossover like Gabby first argued a long time ago in his papers? So let's look at that effect. So let's look at an overdope sample. So now we're at an overdope sample with a TC of only, I think this is 50 Kelvin or something, or 60 Kelvin. And what you see is at low temperatures, first of all, this spectrum looks very different. You have these two peaks. There's no dip here, okay? And as you lower the temperature, what happens? Nothing much. Nothing at all, okay? This peak just gets less sharp, less high, or less tall, let's say. But that's just an effect of the Fermi function, okay? So at low temperatures, you have this little gap, you have this tall peak. At high temperatures, you have this Fermi function just chopping your peak off. But nothing happens to the spectrum, okay? It's just there. Now, this is a bilayer splitting. So in overdose samples, you can see the bilayer splitting very well. This spectrum is qualitatively different from the underdope sample, where instead of having one very broad thing, you get this loss of spectral weight here, which we interpret as due to the interaction of the electron with some collective mode. So they're really qualitatively different. And then you can look at the dispersions and pretty pictures like this. So this is a material with the two copper oxygen planes. These are the two bands here. And you can look at their Fermi surfaces, and they follow exactly the predictions of the LDA about how this thing should split as a function of angle and so on. Okay? And so what this is telling us that for overdope samples, in fact, those two states are coupling into bonding and antibonding combinations, and you can see them very clearly. And if you notice here, there are none of these umflaps and superlattices that normally exist, and the group in Dresden eliminated that by putting 40% lead, and Hélène Raffi, who grew the samples in Paris for us, just grew a very thin epitaxial sample, and this epitaxial strain just seems to wipe out the superlattice. So we don't have to put any extra lead in it. It's just pristine. All right. So now let's look at how this, remember that at optimal doping, there was no interaction between these two things. They were totally degenerate. Okay. So now let's look at the evolution of this thing with temperature here. So this is the raw data. This is the data divided by the Fermi function, so you can see it better. And you can see then that there are two peaks, the antibonding and the bonding peak. This is a really highly overdoped sample, so the antibonding peak is just slightly above about the Fermi energy. And look at this. This is really quite remarkable. As you increase the temperature by not very much, all of a sudden, these two peaks disappear. So it's not just that one peak disappears, they both go. Okay, they both go, and that what that's telling us is that all of a sudden, somewhere here, coherence disappears in and out of the plane at the same time, gone. The system has become incoherent, and then this spectrum that we get here is exactly the spectrum that we got for the optimally doped sample. Okay, so when you're up here, you cannot tell what the doping is. The spectrum looks all the same. So when you're in this sort of strange part, and so we can now do this as a function of doping. Before I do that, Let me show you that. So is this just a surface effect or not? I think it's not, because we did some resistivity measurements just to make sure. So this is the optimally doped sample. It's just linear up to TC. And this is the underdoped sample. And it's hard to see anything directly from here. So we took the derivative just to emphasize, rather than do any fits to that, which is just very dangerous. We just took the derivative to emphasize the component of the scattering of the resistivity. And we get this really interesting result that above some temperature, it's just linear again, just like it was before. But below some temperature, it has some component which the inelastic scattering just grows with temperature. Okay? It happens to grow quadratically, but that's probably an accident. I don't know.
Resistivity is presumably sampling a very different region of the...
No, the resistivity is bulk resistivity. I mean, it's going through the whole thing.
No, but it's dominated by what's going on by a region.
This is a highly overdoped sample. There's no variation around the Fermi surface. In the lifetime, there's no variation in the Fermi velocity, nothing. No, okay, the Fermi velocity varies like the band structure does, a factor of two, but the lifetime does not. Okay, that's a good point. No, this is all BISCO. Yeah. And so we compare the two, so let's look at the spectral weight here, how that decreases, that's plotted in the red dots. So you see when the coherence decreases, the inelastic part of the resistivity increases, and they both stop changing at the same temperature. So there's a direct correlation between the two, okay? So we think this is not just some surface effect. Okay, so we can now do this as a function of temperature and doping, and here's our phase diagram. All right, so this is a region where below this line, there's coherence, and above this line is incoherent. So everywhere in this phase diagram up here, the system is acting strange. And then I noticed something when I did this experiment. Now this was done with just one sample, just by varying the oxygen and measuring things. I noticed some funny thing. So this is the end of the talk, right? I really finished it. I'm just going to speculate for a second here. I noticed that if you extend that line there, it actually goes tangent to here. And so, you know, you want to think of this as coherence. And then there's another line there, and you might want to think of this as pairing. And then when you get pairing and coherence, you get superconductivity. So that's one picture, which we already knew from Gabby's work way back then. But of course, there's a competing picture, which is this one, the quantum critical point. So now our job is try to distinguish this from the other. Thank you.
Very much from Arfas. Some questions?
Do you see shallow lines and things like that in the underdoped regime? And how much does the Fermi surface change when doping?
Do I see shallow what?
Shallow bands.
Shallow bands, yes, we do see shallow bands, but not in the underdoped, in the optimally doped. And it's fair to say that nobody has a clue what they mean. But the strongest at the They go like the TC curve. So if you move away on the overdope or underdope, they gets weaker. It's strongest at the optimal doping. I don't know what they are. And how does the Fermi surface change? It scales like 1 plus x.
A couple of years ago, Coppel and Gross and others worked out a relativistic theory of superconductivity. And one of the surprises was that the spin orbit coupling doesn't just come in as in a standard theory along the diagonal in the number representation, but there is a off-diagonal spin orbit coupling term coming into the Bogolyubov-Dejean equation. And then we worked out the consequences of that with Klaus Coppel, and we found that dichroism is in fact the consequences of this, and it may be relevant to your dichroism. When the superconductivity appears, this off diagonal term can produce dichroism, and that may be the source of it.
Thanks.
Frank.
What is the temperature dependency of the resistivity below 200 Kelvin in this overdope?
Below 200 Kelvin in the overdope?
That deviates from linear.
Oh, I see. Well, if you can fit it by some power, T to some power, which gets bigger than one at one, optimal doping towards so. Two at fully overdoped.
I remember this paper by the Bell group beginning of the 90s on 214 at 33%, where they had 3.5 over two decades.
Yeah, that, it, but,
is that
but
the same?
We didn't, yeah, more or less, but we didn't do that.
So my question is then, couldn't that be just a dimensional crossover? From a quasi 2D at high to a quasi 3D at lower temperature?
Oh, sure. I mean, you could call this a dimensional crossover, sure. I mean, because in this region, the system is coherent, right? You see the bilayer splitting, and in this region, you don't. So it could, yeah, sure. That's a reasonable thing to call it.
So other questions?
The same diagram. It's any change in the C-axis resistivity?
We didn't measure that.
No.
I don't expect any because these things are, each unit cell is insulating with respect to the next unit cell, right? There's two van der Waals coupled layers. So in the normal state, the whole thing is always an insulator. It's just one unit cell big. Huh? Yeah, even in overdose samples. Sure. I mean, unless you dope those, I don't know. I don't know how you could do it. There is no charge transfer between the two bismuth oxygen layers.
Kevin.
Is there some other experiment like optics or something which can probe that broken symmetry? Because people tried many years ago to find time reversal and failed.
Well, no, they didn't fail. They found that there wasn't any. But that was a Q equals zero. Okay? But that's fine. We're finding it at finite vector, at finite Q, pi zero, not at zero zero. I can guarantee you that if we look at zero zero, we'll find nothing. All our matrix elements are zero at the origin, absolutely identically zero. Well, okay. So strictly speaking, what it means is it means magnetism, really. It's just a. Some magnetism of some kind.
As far as I know, the as far as I know, the Dresden group of around Jörg Fink also saw some dichroism.
Yeah, well, I heard, but I haven't seen their paper.
Okay. I wanted to ask whether you can comment whether this agrees or disagrees with what you find.
I don't know the answer because they haven't shown it to me. They said, well, we found some, yeah, but. And they haven't published it, so I don't know. No, I wish somebody would repeat it because this is not enough. This is not. It's too weird. It's just too weird.
Biology. Okay. So if anybody want to make a big comment, it's a time.
Well, no big comments. I'm just I agree that all the temperature dependence is all very peculiar and suggestive, but. Just for my own understanding, suppose there was a distortion of the crystal, which is, tetragonal to orthorhombic in the right direction.
Yes.
Could it in principle give you that signal?
If there was a distortion, it would give us a signal, that's for sure.
But that doesn't make time reversal.
No, that's parity.
Well,
so whenever we do an experiment for time reversal, we always have to worry about parity. That's correct. That's always true. But that's what I said, that's why we measured that's why we tried very carefully to measure if there was any, and to the best of our ability, we cannot see any.
See any what?
Any parity breaking. Okay. Psi of k here is identical to psi of minus k.
And that's the same mirror plane.
That's the same mirror plane. Right. So we tried our best in many ways. By looking at the photoemission, by looking at the X-ray diffraction, which directly measures the angle, okay, to very high precision, and we haven't found any. There might be some somewhere. I don't know. I'm not. Whatever we tried didn't give us a result.
Yeah, if you can put this phase diagram where you show the points where reversal symmetry is broken, right? So it's just in addition to what you said. So in D-wave superconductor, there is a D-wave order parameter itself has orbital momentum, so it will couple to spin orbit, and as you said, it's going to be the effect. So the test for that would be going in overdoped regime, and whether it's the row blue squares is shown to see what happens. Yeah, happens right there. So if that point is red, the consequence would mean that we are dealing with superconductivity in this brown T prime region, and it's can be interpreted. So in different ways. So this is this is very important. This is very important data point there.
Yes.
Whether it's blue or red.
Yeah, unfortunately, after 2 years, my students ran out of patience.
Can somebody explain get time reversal breaking from spin orbit interactions? I don't understand that.
Photo emission, and left-handed and right-handed, the polarized photon will create different different photocurrents. If you solve the Dirac equation and you do the photo emission, that's what you get, and that's what the experimentalist seen in photo emission. It's not even magnetic. Platinum. No magnetic.
But it's for general K point. So it's just a K point.
Yeah.
Which break is
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
There is a much more possibility of a much more subtle effect. Basically the spin orbit coupling is a sigma dot P, and there is a pseudo vector of the angular momentum coming in, sigma dot L. And L is a pseudo vector, and that's what all these Fano and other type of effects have to do with. But there is an extra interesting spin orbit effect comes in a relativistic theory of superconductivity, where off-diagonal part, not just the diagonal part where the electronic structure is, you normally put in a spin orbit coupling, and that's how spin orbit coupling usually dealt with. But in a relativistic theory, there is a mass velocity Darwin, and a spin orbit coupling term comes off on the off diagonal part, and that operates only in a superconducting state. Or as the suggestion here is that maybe if there are preformed pairs, there are pairing fluctuations. Yeah. Yeah, additional effect from the previous. Yes.
Okay, Amar.
Has this experiment been done in any other material?
No.
No.
Not that I believe it, but could you exclude that there is a surface reconstruction which screws up your mirror plane, which you wouldn't see in the X-ray?
No, but we continuously test the we tested that with X-ray diffraction, actually, surface X-ray diffraction.
Okay.
I mean, we could test it with lead, it would be better, but we haven't done that.
Yeah, it's complementary to your question. Would it be conceivable to look for this effect at higher photon energy, or do you need very high photon resolution?
No, you don't need very high resolution. It would be nice to do it with high photon energy, yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely, because we're looking at the whole state. The whole state is doing the thing, so yeah, you don't need very high resolution at all. You need high momentum resolution, but that's another story. Yeah, no, it would be great to do that. It would be great if somebody else could find something.
But since we already started the discussion session, so everybody is welcome to ask a question for Dmitry as well. Yes!
JC, can you comment how you separate bilayer splitting from the mode effect? In both cases, you see two peaks in your data. How do you know that one is bilayer and the other is not?
How do I know one is bilayer and one is not? Well, you can actually see the bilayer in a normal state. So you look in the normal state, right? And in the normal state, do you see it or you don't see it?
You see it as soon as you have quasi-particles.
No, in, yes, okay. So why don't we see it in the superconducting state? All right. So let me, this is a long story, that's why I didn't want to get into it, but let me just give you the...
it's an interesting question, maybe.
Yeah, it's a bit interesting question.
Maybe you could comment on the magnitude of bilayer splitting as function of doping, So if it's changing that...
Look, here's a point. Where is it? The spectra are actually qualitatively different, all right? In the sense that bilayer splitting is just two peaks. What happens when you go into the superconducting state here is you actually lose the spectral weight here, okay? There is... there are two peaks, but they're connected to each other. Okay, in many ways. Okay, so what I have to do now is do something here. Let me show you how they are connected. If I can find the diagram, because I wasn't planning to talk on that, but let me do it. What happens is that those two peaks, we tested that they have the same spectral function. That's what you want to know. Are they the same spectral function or different spectral function, right? If they're two independent peaks, they have different spectral functions. So that's what we did. We tested to the best of our ability to see, okay, here's another way to test. Never mind, that's technical, very technical. But it's, we just look and see if, are they the same spectral function or not? And as far as we can tell, they are the same spectral function.
What do you mean same?
It's just one spectral function that has that shape.
Well, okay. You can fit two peaks in a variety of ways. You can probably fit them with one spectral function with this model, but...
No, but it's not just a fit of the spectral function. No. it's a fact... No, I don't have it here. It's a fact that if you look at their... wait just a second. Then, if you have a second, I will show you. There.
Oh, maybe I would like to comment. Why you said that it's supposed to be two spectral functions? You know, it's one band structure with some matrix element which has bonding anti-bonding component.
Well, a spectral function has one matrix element. Why would it have a different matrix element here and there?
Right.
Huh?
It's just one spectral function.
A spectral function has one matrix element, right? It cannot have two spectral functions.
No.
They have different symmetries.
They would have different.
Right. So here's the point. So where is it? Okay, so there are many tests for this thing. So let's start with this. So since you insist on looking at this, if you look at the way the spectra evolve, okay, in the normal state, you just have this one peak here. Right?
Is that
this is optimally doped. Okay? So you have just one peak. You cool it and you get two peaks. All right? Now you see that this, let's call it two peaks, right? Now let's look at this peak. You see, this peak doesn't disperse at all. All right? Not at all. Mm-hmm. All right? Now this peak disperses. And as soon as we looked at that, all right? We said, I've seen this picture before in Parks, Scalapino's article, and this is exactly what you're looking at. Look, he even calculated the spectral function and he didn't have computers. He put pieces of cardboard and sticks in there. It's exactly the same thing. All right, now that is to contrast that. So what's happening here is, this is the electron dressed by the thing is, and this is just when you recover back the normal state dispersion. And now contrast that with the that dispersion with the, I have to switch to the other one. with the dispersion of the overdoped, which is right there. Okay, look at this. You see? These two are dispersing together very nicely. And they are qualitatively different. Okay? And the reason why people get confused in the literature is because if you don't have a sample which has no super lattice, you can look at it, there aren't any, you will have all kinds of mess in there and it won't look different. But if you have a clean sample where you can just look at these two things and I don't have to do any, you know, any funny business to get it out for you, you can just see it. They are qualitatively different. Okay, and I can go like that on and on and on and on, okay? But there's no point.
No, no, synthesis is a very good point.
Yes, but in underdoped samples, there's still two layers, so there's still bilayer splitting. So now it's either broadened out by the what you call incoherence.
No, the two states are degenerate. You see, if you look at the...
Okay, so you are saying that the interaction T perp
yeah.
is a doping dependent and collapses to zero with...
You're thinking single particles, you know.
Well, no, this is the LDA part, right? Then you add...
Well, the LDA part assumes free electrons. Now look, there are two states. So if when you look at the Fermi surface, the only way you can make sense out of it, the volume of the Fermi surface being equal to the number of carriers, is you assume there are two degenerate ones, okay? They're either two degenerate ones, or they are split and you can count the number of electrons. And you count them here, and you count two of them here, and you get the same answer, or the right answer. Right. But you cannot take one Fermi surface and say, oh, there's got to be another one somewhere, because then you get some crazy number. Mm. And you can read those in the literature. Okay?
So it may be just a randomization to zero. I don't know. We estimate flex renormalization is already a factor of 5. But if you include...
So it drops the...
No. In LDA, bilayer splitting is 400 MeV. In experiments, it's less than... No.
Yeah, it's
70.
Fine.
So yeah. We get 200 easily with the flex normalization.
Yeah.
Okay, I had a question again on this bilayer. So in the underdoped systems, if you looked at the ratio of these two peaks of the quasi-particle and the second peak,
yes,
you had a constant ratio over a range of doping.
Yeah. In the underdoped?
In the underdoped.
Yeah, okay, that's the other thing I wanted to find. I didn't find it, but...
So in the overdoped, if these are actually bilayer split,
In the overdoped, they're different. The ratio
in the overdoped,
over
the ratio should have nothing to do, should not be a constant at all.
That's correct.
Hmm?
So let me see if I can find that data. We did that a long time ago. Stubborn little computer. Okay, so where is that data? I will show you. So, we looked at this very, very carefully. We didn't just pull it out of a hat, really. Here it is. Okay. All right, so here's the story. Okay, you see, look at the energy of this peak and the energy of that peak. And here it is. The peak, the hump, and the NT star, they all scale with each other. Everything scales with one number, J. Yeah, it's bilayer splitting is something completely different. It's related to T perpendicular. This splitting here is related to, there is only one parameter in everything here, that's J. Huh? Did I show you? Yeah, I can go back to it. Yeah, but that's a big difference. You understand? A huge difference. You know, completely different. Yeah?
How does the superconducting gap vary with temperature in the underdoped regime?
Well, this is a superconducting gap with temperature. It's not in here. You mean it grows? Huh? What? Yeah, in the overdoped regime, in the underdoped regime, you just get the pseudo gap, Okay, how does it vary? It's very strange. This is far beyond what I wanted to tell you, but here it is. Okay. Or maybe this one. Okay. There's another one further on, so let me show you. Oops. What did I do? It died altogether. Okay, here it is. This is a gap at pi zero. This is for an overdose sample, 82 Kelvin, underdose 83 Kelvin, same TC. Okay? And look how dramatically different they are. Okay, for an overdose sample, as I showed you, is pretty much BCS. The gap just closes and fills in at the same time. But for underdope, the gap, if you're going to call the gap the peak in the spectral function, doesn't do anything. All it does is it just fills up. Okay? So that's very dramatically different. They're just completely different things. And it's worse than that, because if you go to the underdope side, so let's look at a sample, an underdope sample, and now it even depends where you look, all right? So if I look here, you see the gap isn't doing anything, okay? It's this big gap here, it's just sitting there, and it's just sort of filling in. But if I look here, away from the node, then it's dropping, okay? So you see this little thing is just, you know, it's moving like that. So, you know, it gets even worse. I mean, the more you look, the worse it gets, the weirder it gets. Okay?
I have actually a question to the optimally doped or overdoped samples gap, because when you measure specific heat, you find that it is not at all mean field-like because of the small coherence length. You would actually see a sort of more XY-like behavior. So actually, you should see in the order parameter not a square root behavior, but a behavior something like one-third or roughly one-third. Are your data precise enough to actually distinguish between those possibilities?
No, not by far. Not by far. I just showed you the value of the gap as a function of doping, temperature. You know, the exact variation, you know, this is not a good experiment to measure order parameter like that.
You shouldn't expect mean field-like behavior.
No, but it's, what I'm saying is it's very different from this behavior, that's all. It's close to mean field, but not exactly mean field. So was this in an overdose sample, your experiment? Okay. Yeah. No. Maybe I overstated that point. I take your point. Thanks.
This is for Dimitri too. When you observe the bilayer, are the samples metallic in the Z direction?
Say that again.
When you observe the bilayer splitting.
No, they're not. No, they're no different than any other time. The bilayer is just two layers. Then you have an insulator in between, and then you have two other layers. The two bismuth oxygen layers are insulating. Okay? Then you have the other bilayer in this material. The resistivity and isotropy is huge everywhere.
It's still more conductive.
It's a problem.
Huh?
It's more conductive.
It's more conductive, but you still have orders of magnitude difference between this direction and that direction, right?
It's a problem.
Yeah.
Just for my information, that the gap size behave proportional to T star in the underdope regime, like in the tunneling.
I thought I showed you that. Where is it? I showed you that. It's in the other curve. Sorry. Okay. What is this? I should have a mouse. Where is it? Yeah, it's proportional to the T star. Yeah, there it is.
Maybe since computer is...
Sorry, it's just that looking in here, because my screen is dark.
Okay, take your time, so I will just ask a crucial next question, so about other group reproduce time reversal symmetry? I know the Dresden group try, maybe you know some.
I don't know, they haven't told me their results.
I see.
Yeah, here it is, okay. That's a superconducting gap, and that's T star, and they're just a multiple of each other. Yeah. Okay,
so if there is no other question, let's thank GC again for beautiful talk and a nice discussion.